Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You will find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm John Farmer, Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, providing the introductions for the program. Today's program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker and our moderator. Dr. Abbas Milani is the Hamid and Christina Mogahedem Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and professor in the Stanford Global Studies Division, as well as a research fellow with the Hoover Institute. Dr. Milani is a scholar and expert in U.S. and Iranian relations, as well as Iranian culture, political, and security issues. He has published more than 20 books and 200 articles and book reviews in scholarly magazines, journals, and newspapers. His work has been translated into more than 10 languages. His latest book, The Shah, published in 2011, was a New York Times bestseller, and critics have observed about the book, and I quote, "Like all histories, The Shah is as much about the future as it is about the past. I have read it, and I give it an unqualified recommendation as a must read." Dr. Milani received his BA in political science at UC Berkeley and his PhD at the University of Hawaii. Tonight, his subject is the rise of ISIS and the changing landscape of the Middle East. Our moderator for tonight's program is Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. He is an award-winning journalist, having been with some of the most prestigious and respected newspapers in the country, including the Boston Globe, New York Times, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Abbas Milani and Robert Rosenthal to tonight's Commonwealth Club of California Forum. Thank you.
Good evening. Welcome to all of you. And thank you, John, for that wonderful introduction. I just have to make one slight correction to it. The Shah, unfortunately for my pocket, was not a New York Times bestseller. But it was picked as one of the books of the year by Wall Street Journal. It might make you feel better, but it doesn't make you feel any richer. Since I'm about to deliver some sobering news, I thought I will begin by quoting some passages from one of my favorite poems. It's by William Butler Yeats. "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. And what rough beast is our come around at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born." This is a poem Yeats wrote in 1921, and we know now what he knew then, that there was a rough beast about to be born, and it wasn't going to Bethlehem. It was bringing destruction to much of the world then. The new beast, the new rough beast, isn't going to Bethlehem. If you read their literature, if you look at the map that they have put on the website about what their goals are, they intend in the next 5 years to go to the entire Middle East, all of Central Asia, all of Europe, much of North Africa, Turkey, much of the Caucasus, and eventually, according to their verbal claims, America. They say, of course, always, inshallah. They claim that they represent the only form of Islam that is legitimate and that follows the ways of the Prophet. And I'll try to explain why they make that claim. To give you a sense of their size, I don't think it matters whether you call them ISIS, ISIL, IS, Islamic State, Daesh, which they don't like. You can get punished if you call them Daesh in their territory. But let me give you a sense of their proportion. The territory they now control is larger than the United Kingdom. The population they control is larger than Denmark. They have close to $2 billion in cash. And the cash register is ringing every day to the tune of $2 million till 10 days ago from oil and gas sale alone. They also have revenues from taxes. They have revenues from selling women and children as slaves. They make no bones about it. This is not propaganda against them. They are proud of the fact that they sell women and children as slaves. They are in extortion, and they are in selling antiquities. Much of Iraq's and Syria's antiquities in their territories have now been put on the black market. In Mosul alone, they got their hands on $700 million in cash. So you're talking about a group that is very, very well oiled. You're talking about a machine that is very well oiled. And if you want to get a sense of how complicated the situation is, everybody knew that they were selling oil and gas on the black market. The Syrians knew it. The Turks knew it. The United States knew it. Only till last week were their refineries bombed by the alliance. Why wasn't Syria, that has used its air force to bomb innocent civilians, innocent peaceful demonstrators, destroyed much of the infrastructure of the country, go after their oil? The answer to me is rather simple. They wanted ISIS to become as strong as ISIS became, because they wanted the Obama administration, they wanted the West to face the choice they thought from the beginning was the choice, either me or radical Islamist. He forgot that he bombed innocent, peaceful, democratic demonstrators. And out of that chaos, and out of the chaos of U.S. inaction and Obama's inaction, a vacuum was created wherein the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar decided to get into the act. And out of that mismatch and dangerous combination, you have the birth of this phenomenon. Richard Dearlove, who was James Bond's real boss, if there ever was a James Bond, this is the head of MI6, recently gave a talk at a think tank, a British think tank called Rust, of all names for a think tank. He says, during the Cold War, 38% of the intelligence budget for England was dedicated to fighting the Soviet Union, the communist threat. Today, 50% of that intelligence budget is dedicated to fighting Islamic terrorism, what he calls Islamic terrorism. He believes, of course, that much of the hype about this, and he made this lecture 2 weeks too early, I think. He says much of the hype in the, is over-exaggerated. But then he goes on to say something rather remarkable for the head of MI6. He says, ISIS would not have been imaginable without the financial support of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and rich Kuwaitis. He then goes on to say, I have no evidence that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were, as a government, involved in helping supply ISIS, but these things, he says, don't happen spontaneously. And when the boss of MI6 says things don't happen spontaneously, I think you can surmise what happens. I believe in politics in general, but certainly in the politics of the Middle East, there is karma. ISIS is the result of 150 years of bad choices, bad policies made in the West and bad choices made in the Islamic world. It is very easy to find a culprit and blame. Particularly after Tuesday's election, it is very easy to blame it all on Obama. It is no less easy to blame it all on Bush. It is equally easy to blame it on Clinton. You can go back. Unfortunately, I have to say, after Nixon and Kissinger, no American president, at least as I understand it, has had a cogent policy about the Middle East. They've had reactions to events, but they haven't had a strategic vision of where the Middle East is going, who are the players, and where does the United States stand? Where do these different players stand? The United States went from supporting Iran all the way to supporting Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war, to then supporting Iran, and then to Saudi Arabia. If you look at it historically, it has been truly a rather confusing game, and every one of the presidents that I mentioned, I think, bears some responsibility, and it's far too easy to make that blame. In the question and answer, I can tell you some of what I think about could have been done differently. If you think about ISIS as the metaphor that is most often used as a cancer, and I think it is in a sense cancer, but it is first and foremost a cancer in the body politic of Islam. Like all cancers, if you want to understand it, you must understand what its root is. You must understand why it has grown, and you must understand how to fight it. And that body where the cancerous growth is the only body that can fight it. If the body doesn't want to fight it, that cancer is not going to go away. If the Islamic world does not decide that it must put an end to this kind of radicalism, bombing it is not going to work. You can't bomb cancer. You can kill the patient, but you can't cure the cancer. So in my view, the most important part of this is that the Islamic world has to take hold of this issue, has to take issue, and has to begin cleaning their house and making it known. It's not going to be enough for 100 scholars to say this is a bad interpretation of Islam, as they did in a recent statement. That's not going to do it. The Islamic societies have to decide that there must be an end to this kind of radical brutality. And the Islamic world is increasing as we speak. Let me give you a couple of statistics that will give you a sense of the dimensions of the problem. Today, there are 22% of the world population. According to the Pew, by 2030, they will be 26.4% of the world population. Today, we have 2.6 million Muslims in America. By 2030, there will be 6.5 million, almost. In Europe, today, there are 44 million Muslims. By 2030, there will be 58 million. Today, there are 1.1 billion Muslims. By 2030, there will be 1.3 and a half billion. Only 178,000 of them are in Pakistan. If you look at the number of failed states from Sudan and Libya to Iraq and Syria, and add that population, and add the population of Afghanistan, Pakistan as a possibly failing state, the image of what this population could potentially be as a source of mobilization becomes clear. Now, let me be very, very clear on one other point. Pew shows this. Most other credible public surveys show it, that the greatest majority, sometimes up to 90-odd percent of the Muslims in these worlds, in these parts of the world, have no sympathy for ISIS. In some parts of the Muslim world, ISIS support is less than 1%. So we are not talking about massive support for this interpretation of Islam. But we're talking about a very large population. And out of that large population, in order to create mayhem, in order to create savagery, and I'll tell you why I choose the word savagery, you need a very, very, very small percentage to succeed. Even 0.01% of this large population spread out throughout the world can be a potential source of great disability, great danger to all of these countries in the world. Now, if you remember ISIS as the continuation of Al-Qaeda, ISIS today is the result of the ruins of ISIS in Iraq. When ISIS in Iraq was defeated, when Zarqawi was killed, some would say, with hints coming from some of his comrades who thought that he was too violent, they left Iraq and settled in Syria. The war in Syria was reaching a chaotic new stage, and they began to work in that new atmosphere. But they began to work in a very different way. They're a very different category than Al-Qaeda was. Al-Qaeda was keen on destruction. These are people keen on building a state. I gave you a sense of the state they have already built. They are enormously savvy in terms of their use of the social media. They have websites in 23 languages. They have a magazine that I strongly urge you to go look if you haven't looked. There is a very bad, good English translation of it. It's called Dabeq. Go online and look at the pages. Look at how much money they have spent in laying the page in some of the pictures. The pictures are sometimes gruesome, sometimes not as gruesome. And the rhetoric is remarkable. The unabashed defense of violence, the unabashed defense of slavery, the unabashed defense of the second-class citizenship for women, second-class citizenship for Jews and Christians, and no-class citizenship for anyone who is not one of these three faiths. Non-Muslims don't have the right to live in this community. People who have lived in that area, from Izzadis or Yazidis to Assyrians who have lived in that territory, who have lived there 1,000 years before Islam came there, now no longer have the right to live in their homelands, and they're being driven out by it. But they're being driven out by it by a very sophisticated machine that combines violence, that combines social media savvy, that combines enormous ability to collect funds. There are actually in Saudi Arabia, they have now been stopped, in some of the Persian Gulf states, advertisements by groups connected to ISIS who say, give us 2,500 and we'll place one jihadi on the war front for you. They are very good at this social network. They even have an online site, a finishing school for lady jihadists. If you want to join the jihadists as the wife of a jihadist, you can sit on an online course. They'll teach you how to sew, how to cook, how to clean a gun, and how to be a good wife to a jihadist. There are now folks anywhere between, the minimum guess is 20,000, the maximum is 80,000. People from 80 different countries fighting under that banner. And they're fighting because they get paid $1,000 a month. The jihadi ladies, if they get married with a husband, they get 1 week of a vacation on the Euphrates River with a $700 honeymoon gift. These are, you laugh and it's funny, but it is dangerous. This is a serious problem. They have combined the brutality of the most violent aspects of Islam 1,400 years ago, with the internet savvy of 21st century and with enormous cash that they have at their disposal. If they didn't have that cash, they would be a mere footnote to Islamic history. Now, in trying to understand ISIS, it is, in my view, or in trying to contextualize it is as easy and facile to blame one president or blame one country. The Iranian regime, for example, blames Israel and the United States for the creation of ISIS. It says ISIS is an American version of Islam. It is intended to sideline Iran and sideline Islamic Republic. But I believe that to be nonsense. But it is equally, in my view, facile to blame ISIS and Islam. The notion that is now very popular by these hipsters who either defend Islam or defame it, accuse Islam of all manner of violence or defend it as the religion of peace, is that the fundamental assumption is, in my view, a wrong assumption. When you ask whether ISIS is representative of Islam, you are assuming that there is one Islam against which ISIS can be judged. We don't have one Islam. We've never had one Islam after the death of the Prophet. After the death of the Prophet, there were different Islams, and there have been different Islams. There was a time where the Islamic world was the center of learning, the center of science. Without the Islamic world, the Renaissance in Europe might well not have happened. The notion that Islam cannot tolerate reason, the notion that Islam cannot tolerate discussion, is a figment of two imaginations. The Sikh fundamentalists in the Islamic world and the Sikh Islamophobes in the West, neither of which accept the plurality that is Islam. And that's why I say, unless we get both sides of this debate back to a more more reasonable discussion, we're not going to get far. Now, if you want to understand a little bit about the roots of ISIS, I suggest you think about two concepts. One is the concept of the Middle East, and the other one is the concept you have all heard about called Allahu Akbar. Okay? Where does the concept of the Middle East come from? Why is the Middle East the Middle East? Here you have a civil place, regardless of where you define it, from Egypt to Turkey, that is the center of some of the greatest world empires, from the Babylonians and the Assyrians, and I have to mention Assyrians because my boss, Narsi David, is sitting there, and he'll call me if he says, how come you didn't mention the Assyrians? And Ashurbanipal, some of the greatest empires of the past, the Persian Empire, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, all of these come from this place. It's 4,000 years of history. Some would say 7,000. Why is it called the Middle East? Middle East compared to what? When was it called the Middle East? It wasn't called the Middle East in 19th century. It only began to be called the Middle East in late 19th century, when England and eventually France, reluctantly, began to think of themselves as the center of the world. And from that view, Middle East is the Middle East. If you live in Silicon Valley, the Middle East is Kansas. If you live in Alaska, the Middle East, you must ask Ms. Palin where that part is. So the concept of Middle East was first coined, by some accounts, by the India Office, the British India Office. Some say an American admiral first coined it. No American president ever used the concept of Middle East to refer to the Middle East till late 1950s. So Middle East was a concoction of essentially British colonialism. And a man who had an enormous amount to do with it has also a lot to do with the creation of ISIS. Some of you have met some version of him in Lawrence of Arabia. The character played by Claude Rains, which was essentially the same character he played in Casablanca. This time it was in Arabia. The character was a composite of Sykes. Sykes was a British aristocrat who fancied himself a historian, fancied himself a diplomat, and had much to do with coining the phrase Middle East to refer to the Middle East. He's also the most important person to have signed two of the most critical documents that shaped the 20th century politics of the Middle East. One is the Percy-Sykes secret agreement, and the other one is the Balfour Declaration. The second one resulted in the creation of the State of Israel. Sykes, Picot essentially divided what Sykes thought was the last caliphate. He's written a book about the history of the Ottomans. He called The Last Legacy of the Caliphates. Well, the last legacy of the caliphates wasn't the Ottoman Empire. The last legacy of the caliphates is Mr. Baghdadi, who now considers himself a current caliph, and blames Sykes Picot for bringing in infidels into the region. And by infidels, he just doesn't mean all of you who are not Muslims. He means all of you, including if you are a Muslim, unless you're a supporter of ISIS. I hope you're not in the room. But for them, the entire Islamic world is now besought by what they call the age of savagery. If you want to really understand where ISIS comes from, I strongly suggest you go online and read a book called Management of Savagery. It is by a gentleman named Abu Bakr Naji. Harvard University has translated it. You can download it for free and read it. There you're as likely to hear a quote from the Quran as a quotation from Paul Kennedy, the professor who talks about the end of the American empire. The fundamental theory that ISIS is basically promoting is that with Sykes-Picot and with World War II, the Crusaders, the infidels, created a world order that was primarily intended to manifest their hegemony and undermine Islam. Now it is time to challenge that. Now it is time to overthrow that system. In Afghanistan, they said, we destroyed one of the two main culprits in creating this unfair world, the two superpowers, Soviet Union. Now our job is, they say, undermining and defeating the second. And we can defeat the second because the United States is weak, they say. The United States is overextended, they say. The people of the United States don't want to fight another war, they say. I'm quoting almost verbatim. All you need to do is kill a few Americans, and the president has no choice but to flee. And nevertheless, the way to defeat the U.S., they say, is to get them to land forces and fight us here. That's where the name for their journal comes. If after reading Management of Savagery, you still have some time left, go online and read the journal Dabeq. The name Dabeq comes from what they claim to be a very reliable hadith. Islam has two foundational ideas for its jurisprudence. One is the Quran, and one is the hadith, words and deeds alleged to have been uttered or performed by the Prophet, and for some Muslims, by the Prophet and his progeny. They claim, although Muhammad never in his life claimed to have any miracles, except the Quran, but they claim 1,400 years ago, Muhammad predicted that if you get Rome, then the Byzantine, now the West, if you get Rome to come and fight in the village of Dabeq, that will bring Armageddon and will come bring the end of the world. That is the view that they have. The view that they have is an apocalyptic millenarian view. It is very polished. It is not a hodgepodge. It is very internet savvy. They fully understand our, I'm sad to say, the sick world, where millions have the appetite to watch a beheading on YouTube. They know that that beheading will get a lot of attention. And part of the reason they put it, and I'm quoting, is that because in order to manage the savagery that the West has inflicted on the Islamic world, we must outdo them in their savagery. We must bring fear to their hearts. And because they are fearing people, they're not as brave as we are, because we are God's chosen, they will more easily be frightened. That's why that beheading, that's why this violence, that's why the article about slavery that I mentioned is in those journals. I said, I'm going to ask you to think about two concepts. One was the Middle East. The other one is what you have all heard, Allahu Akbar. The standard translation for this is that God is great. Well, this is not a right translation. Allahu Akbar doesn't mean God is great. Akbar means greater. God is greater. Some translations would say God is the greatest. Much of the Muslim world, again, I would say the greatest majority of the Muslim world, understand Allahu Akbar to be God is great, which means the God of Judaism is also great. The God of Christianity is also great. Although they don't believe that Jesus Christ is God, they accept it. But God, Allahu Akbar means God is greater. And that's where ISIS comes in. ISIS believes that their God is not the equal to God of Christianity, but it's the greatest God. They believe the Abrahamic traditions follow the trajectory. They began with Judaism. They began with Abraham. They end in Islam. Islam is the final word. That's why some of the more radical Islamists in ISIS don't even accept that they should take extra tax and allow Jews and Christians to continue their faith, as it is clearly stated in the Quran. They find another passage in the Quran that says, we gave them the book, now we have given them the better book. So their argument is, you now have the better book. If you don't follow it, we will kill you. The more liberal ISIS says, if you give us extra tax, if you accept second-class citizenship, if you don't proselytize, if you come out of your neighborhood only when we tell you, then we'll let you live. These are certainly one interpretation of the text that we have talked about. They are not the only interpretation. To me, it is as folly to say that this is un-Islamic as it is to say this is the Islamic interpretation. But they are tapping into an enormous history of resentment. They're tapping into a history of racism in Europe, where much of the Muslim community is in ghettos. They're tapping into every Islamophobic, idiotic comment made on Fox News or any other news about the Islamic world. They take it, they cherry pick it, and they put it as a sign of the crusade. In other words, they're tapping into an enormous resentment, and they have the cash. I'm going to finish in 3-4 minutes, right? I have 5 minutes. And they're tapping into another very important sense of Islamic response to something that happened around 18th century. I said at one time Islam was at the forefront of science and reason and discovery, of astronomy. The best astronomers in the world lived in the Islamic world. But by the 18th century, the Islamic world had fallen badly behind. The Renaissance had happened in Europe, and the Islamic world had fallen badly behind. Two very different responses began to take shape in the Islamic world. One was We have fallen behind because we haven't paid enough attention to science and reason and philosophy and rationalism, and we should incorporate all of these things into our societies. We should learn from the West. Another response was, no, the reason, we don't even want to be in that game. We don't want to catch up with the West. The West is going astray. The idea that women and men are equal is the wrong idea because it's not in the Quran. We should go back to the ways of our past. We should go back to the ways of the Salaf, the earlier. Salafism comes out of this tendency. The most important movement for Salafi thought happened in Arabia in this period, led by a man called Abdul Wahhab. He began to offer a version of Islam that was purely prophetic in his word. He believed in one interpretation of the text. He believed in one interpretation of the true path of the Prophet. And he believed that everything else, including the entire up-to-then history of Islam, except the first four caliphs, the first 30 years after the death of the Prophet, has been a form of sinful existence. We must go back to the way of the Prophet. If oil hadn't been discovered in Saudi Arabia, if Abdul Wahhab had not made a pact with one of the tribes at the time, the Saud tribe, and create out of them the Saudi current structure, again, this reading would have been a minor footnote in the history of Islam. But from 1970s, when oil revenues increased, from 1992, when the clergy in Saudi Arabia essentially gave an ultimatum to the royal family, demanding the creation of an Islamic ministry, demanding that in every embassy they have a representative who would be promoting their version of Islam, this would not have happened. They have billions of dollars, billions who they have spent in the creation of schools and creation of mosques and creation of seminaries, who promote to a creation of centers for Islamic studies in American universities, who promote a more puritanical version of Islam, who promote the idea that that version of Islam is the only pure version of Islam. That provides the theoretical background. The resentment, the arrogance of Sykes-Picot provides the historical background. The economic needs of the unemployed in some of the Muslim countries where these people are now mobilizing, unemployment is sometimes 30-40%, provides the economic. Their savvy provides, their internet savvy provides their ability to mobilize. Their ability to join forces with Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist commanders allows them to combine remarkable tactics that they have learned in Afghanistan and they have learned in Libya with techniques of the traditional warfare. If you look at the places they attack clear, strategically important places that has gas, oil, water, wheat, or cash. The only place where they have fought a fight that I still don't understand why they are other than its propaganda value is Kobani. Usually they come, hit. They took Mosul, the second largest city, in a day, by some accounts, with 800 fighters. But we know that it wasn't 800 fighters. We know that they have cells, sleeper cells, in Mosul before. We know they now have sleeper cells in Baghdad. Look at the number of suicide bombings they have organized in Baghdad in the last 2 weeks alone. They are 20 to 30 miles outside Baghdad airport. They have surface-to-air missiles. And if they cross the river, they can literally stop, by some very conservative estimates, air traffic into Baghdad. So the danger is serious. The answer is not simple. The answer that Mr. McCain yesterday gave in an interview, that we should put boots on the ground, is not necessarily the answer. The answer is going to take a lot of wisdom. There is a wonderful Persian expression. I began by Yeats, I must finish with Persian expression. There's a wonderful Persian expression that says, it takes one madman to put a stone down a well, it will take 10 wise people to bring it out of the well. Now we have 150 years of madmen throwing stones down this well, and it's going to take a lot of collective wisdom, prudence, both in the Islamic world and in the rest of the world, to get us out of this rather difficult position. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Dr. Abbas Milani for that remarkable presentation. He's a noted Middle East scholar and director of the Iranian Studies Program at Stanford University and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting and your moderator for this evening's audience question period. So we've got many questions, but I want to start with one because I'm going to have to sort of collate a lot of the ideas here. It almost seems as if, like dragon's teeth sown in the ground, ISIS sprang out of nowhere. Can you give us, and they've got tremendous infrastructure, as you described. They've got taxation. They have a propaganda public relations campaign that's brilliant, some would say. How did this happen? And is it something we should have been more aware of from an American perspective? And how was this organized in the last few years, or was it longer in the making?
No, it's been much longer in the making, and some of you who paid your taxes in the 70s and 80s and 90s helped train them. Don't forget, many of these people are veterans of Afghanistan. Don't forget that in 1975, the biggest outside Langley office for the CIA was in Pakistan, and their job was essentially to translate Quran and distribute it in the Islamic part of the Soviet Union. The idea was that the only way you're going to undermine the Soviet Union was the help of Islam. Remember that in Afghanistan, Ronald Reagan brought the jihadists and said, these are our founding fathers. These are like our founding fathers. And this happened remarkably after the 1979 revolution in Iran, which was essentially the same mistake. The Shah destroyed all opposition except the Islamic forces because he thought the main danger were the communists and the Muslims are the ones who can get them. Well, they got the communists, but they had a remarkable infrastructure. I mean, if you look at the infrastructure that Muslims had created, the radical Islamists had created in Iran from 1941 to 1979, it's a story that hasn't been told. I'm beginning to scratch the surface, and I'm dumbfounded by how everybody, the CIA, the Shah's secret police, Iranian intellectuals, they were all infatuated with leftist intellectuals, while these guys under the radar were creating the most remarkable network, nimble, multifaceted. Iranian intellectuals were publishing journals with 4,000 or 5,000 circulation. These guys were publishing journals with 70, 80,000 circulation. Nobody was then or has since read them. You go there and you find these people are masters in creating these kinds of networks. They're tapping into that. They're tapping into the finances they have collected from there. So look at, I mean, many of these in the Sunni world are offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was formed in 1929. They have been at this since 1929. They have been articulating this view that the West is evil, that we don't want it. Read the writings of Sayyid Qutb. If we had had this conversation 2 years ago, I would have said, this is the most important man in the development of ISIS, probably, and nobody, there isn't a single biography of him. Now there is a biography of him. God is the fountainhead of this kind of thinking. Until 2 years ago, there wasn't a single book about him in English. When I tried to order his books for one of my classes at Stanford 7 years ago, I had to order it from a bookstore in Syria. This is the equivalent of trying to teach a course on Catholicism and not being able to find the St. Augustine book, except in Aleppo.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Dr. Abbas Milani, noted Middle East scholar, who is discussing the rise of ISIS and its impact on the Middle East and the rest of the world. You alluded to solutions. You alluded to the cancerous growth within Islam and how Islam had to deal with this. If President Obama called you to meet not only with him, but the Republican leadership, because I think this is going to take a concerted agreement to try and resolve these issues, what advice would you give them?
I would advise them to thread gingerly, to thread humbly, to understand the complexity of the problem, to forego the kind of arrogance that believes that any time you desire to have a problem solved, American planes or American boots on the ground can solve it. No, sometimes a problem that has been 100 years in the making is going to take more than just some troops on the ground to undo. It's going to require a massive rethinking of American priorities. At Stanford University, where some of the elite of this country are trained, till 10 years ago, there wasn't a center for the study of Islam. There wasn't a center for the study of Iran. A Stanford graduate went out of Stanford without ever taking a course on Islam and Iran. And you read every president since Carter who says, Islamic Republic of Iran is the biggest challenge facing the United States. What did the U.S. do when the Soviet Union was the challenge? They started studying the Soviet Union. They started studying language. They started teaching language, the culture, the music, all of these things. The number of places studying Islam and Iran have either shrunk or some of it has been created by money designated to certain types of studies. Where is the U.S. government investment in all of this? Where is the U.S. government investment in teaching Arabic? At one time, till a few months ago, they had four Arab-speaking members in Iraqi U.S. embassy in Iraq. Four. Out of 2,000 or 2,500. Condi Rice, when she was studying Soviet Union, somebody told me she could name the children of every member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. That's how in-depth her view was. Senator Kerry, during his presidential campaign, was very impressed with a book that says Shiites and Sunnis are very different.
We're dealing, obviously, with a moment of incredible chaos. Hearing you tonight and hearing your description and background on ISIS makes it, you could argue, it's a number one threat to the world, potentially. But you also have a situation where the Middle East is in chaos. You have the whole question with Iran, the nuclear issue. You have Egypt dealing with its own problems. Libya is in chaos. Obviously, the civil war in Syria. The vested interests, the secular, the Sunni-Shia split. How do you bring in now, what's Iran's role and the United States' role? Can they come together to find a solution? Is it happening quietly? Is an Iranian-U.S. alliance on this crucial to finding a solution, and where did the Saudis come in?
My sense is that they are working together quietly. My sense is that there is some place where there is a convergence of interest. Both of them, United States and Iran, are afraid of ISIS. But how to get rid of ISIS, they don't share at all. Iran wants to get rid of ISIS in order to get rid of their allies' staunchest enemy, that is Bashar Assad. The United States, at least many in the United States, the Republican majority now, want to get rid of Assad. It is not clear where President Obama stands on this. So they don't have a convergence. The force that could be remarkably effective in fighting ISIS has decided to stay on the sideline. When Kobani was being bombarded, Turkey had hundreds of tanks lined up on the border. They were sitting there watching the game as if it is
video game. Turkey is the one that should have. But why is Turkey not going? Because Turkey says, if I'm going to go in, I need you to sign on the destruction of Assad. I need you to make sure that there is no independent Kurdistan in Iraq. Although Turkey can buy illegal oil from them at a discount price, but you can't declare independent Kurdistan. So to get this alliance, to get those who you need to get, Iran needs the United States as much as the United States needs Iran. Because remember, Daesh kills a lot of Sunnis, but their number one game is to kill Shiites, because they don't even think Shiites are Muslims. They never call Shiites by any name other than Safavid. And Safavid is the name of a dynasty that ruled Iran. They consider the Iranian Shiites the number one, and they're very open about it. And they're now maybe 80, 70 kilometers from Iranian border. Iranians are now openly, they have been openly talking about how they have sent forces to fight Daesh. There is a picture this morning at the website that belonged to Ayatollah Khamenei. The pictures that are on that site are as controlled as the pictures during Kremlin time, when you could watch a picture during Stalin and know who is in, who is out, and where they sat next to Stalin, you knew who was getting out of favor. That's how controlled that is. In today's picture, Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Brigade, is sitting two persons from Ayatollah Khamenei. He has never been that close.
So with the interest really of their own local politics and loan issues in this part of the world, what would bring Turkey to take action? Is it an ISIS threat within their own country? The Saudis obviously, you know, are now probably backing off the funding. So what do you see happening, I guess, is a question everyone here would like to have answered. And is there, besides a military option short-term and then dealing with the cancer long-term, any other potential solution to this?
I think we are beginning to see the convergence of that solution, because all of the countries that have one way or another, directly or indirectly, helped beget this ISIS are now realizing that it might come back and haunt them. Turkey, with its very powerful intelligence organization, looked the other way when thousands of jihadis were going through Turkey to join ISIS. But now they suddenly have realized that there might be 1,000 Turks who are fighting with them, and all you need to disrupt life in Turkey is for 10 of those guys to come back. So they're recognizing it. Iran, that helped create ISIS by supporting Syria, is now realizing that ISIS might come back to bite it. Saudi Arabia, that helped fund it, has just gotten the first taste of what ISIS can do to Saudi Arabia. They just had a bombing killing some Shiites in the Shiite-dominated parts of Saudi Arabia, and that's where the oil-rich parts of Saudi Arabia. And if that begins to turn into a major confrontation, you can see Iran getting involved there. And we haven't even talked about Yemen, where there's another civil war that is pitting Iran against the West and Saudi Arabia. Iran is supporting the Houthis. The rest of the world are supporting the other people. So my sense is that with the increased danger, with the recognition that this is going to come back to bite everybody, everybody is going to have to put aside their maximum game and agree on a minimal point of convergence, which is containing, because you can't, it's not going to be easy to unseat them, in my view. You can contain them, you can slow their growth, as some of these airstrikes seems to have done, and then the only thing that is going to solve this, as I said before, is for the Muslim societies to come to the conclusion that religion and politics must stay separate. Once you open that door, you open the door to this kind of a radical interpretation, and it's very hard to close it. Once you say, I, in Iran, once Ayatollah Khomeini says, I, in Iran, am Amir al-Mu'mineen, the head of all Muslims in the world. And he literally says that, as does Khamenei. And they are at best 25% of the entire Islamic world. If you consider Iran 75 million, they're not even, if you have, if you give yourself the right to do that, what gives you the right to then stop somebody from Baghdadi to get on his high horse and say, I am Amir al-Mu'mineen, I am the Khalifa? We have to say, you want to play Khalifa, do it in the privacy of your home. In politics.
This is a question from someone in the audience. Would you agree with the assessment that the U.S.'s current strategic goal is, this is the three-part question, is to keep Assad in power, given the following: Obama's refusal to hold red lines, two, U.S. bombing of Assad's opponents, as we're seeing now, and the recent U.S. announcement to end funding for investigations of Assad's war crimes?
I have to say, I really don't know what Obama's game plan in Syria is, unfortunately. I think the time he should have acted, to be very honest with you, was when Assad began to kill innocent citizens. The United States should have signed on with Turkey, with some in Europe who were willing and anxious to declare a no-fly zone, to tell Assad the red line should have been, don't use heavy weaponry against innocent people. Once they didn't do that, the chaos ensued. So I don't know what his strategy is, unfortunately. I think, and if you look at the front line had a documentary on what ISIS, and you know, I had it in my notes, but I forgot to say it. You know, the notion of trying to find one conversation to blame for everything that happened in the Middle East is a proclivity that sometimes investigative journalists have. Excuse me, you're one of the best. But, you know, there was a conversation between the American ambassador and Saddam Hussein, and that led to Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. No, Saddam was a thug. There was a question of money. That conversation might have been a trigger, but it had much more cause. Now, they say, the cause for ISIS was a conversation between Maliki and Obama. When Maliki was visiting Obama, he got a call saying that his deputy has some bodyguards who are assassins. And he tells Mr. Obama that, you know, my deputy has assassins as bodyguards. And Frontline says, Mr. Obama says, well, your country has laws, go act the laws. He thought that meant go get them. And he went with ferocity against Sunnis, went against every Sunni sect, and got us to where we are. To me, that conversation might have been a trigger. But the reason Maliki went after Sunnis is because he is a sectarian, ideologically dogmatic, dangerous man. That should have been very clear, and it was pointed to the Americans when they decided to back him, when they backed him.
There's a lot of questions here about if the U.S. had stayed, if Obama had kept troops on the ground. But based on what I'm hearing you say, it's almost, this crisis has been almost inevitable, and it's been going on for over a century in terms of where we are today, in terms of the radicalization. What would have happened, do you think, if Saddam Hussein was still in power? Would we be here today? Or would it just been, when he's gone, this would have come up?
Well, I think if Saddam Hussein had been in power, he would have continued slaughtering the Kurds. He would have continued slaughtering the Shiites. He would have continued, you know, slaughtering the Sunnis who didn't follow his line. I mean, Saddam Hussein was a two-bit despot who is responsible for many hundreds of thousands of deaths. So I think the fall of Iraq would probably not have happened under that quickly. But Iraq, is in its current constellation, is the result of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. It doesn't make sense to configure a society that has a Kurdish minority that is being oppressed, a Sunni majority at that time, Sunni population that is lording it over the others, and you have a Shiite minority that is very powerful, but is constantly denied power. And there is an Iranian nation next door that is pouring in money and pouring in support under the Shah, and even more now, to consolidate that. So to me, a centrally despotically controlled Iraq was not a solution. Incidentally, when Britain first did it, there was a revolution in 1922, and England's solution was almost exactly like Obama's solution. Say, we'll bomb them, and we'll bomb them into silence. They use heavy hand. They quieted down this uprising. But those tensions have continued, like the tectonic plates of an earthquake.
One of the things you talked about was that you felt like about 1% of Muslims really were represented in the values of ISIS. But how does a group like ISIS come in and control these vast areas? Is it through the savagery you described? Is it through fear? Are they in Sunni enclaves now where there's more connection to the belief? And can they? How are they managing to manage, really, and govern?
Well, they managed to take Mosul because the Mosulite Sunnis and the tribes around Mosul had become extremely disgruntled with Maliki. The United States had essentially paid these tribal chiefs to stop killing Americans and join a coalition with Maliki, a coalition government. When Maliki came, they stopped the payment, and not only that, they went after them. So at the first sign of a possible alliance with another Sunni who would give to Maliki what they thought Maliki had coming, they switched sides. Virtually the entire Iraqi army in Mosul. It is truly one of the more remarkable feats of defeat. Each one of you have probably paid a couple of $1,000s of your taxpayer to train Iraqi soldiers, and virtually the whole thing collapsed because there was such a strong anti-Maliki sentiment and the Sunni tribes that were critical. And then they had sleeper cells that composed of Baathists, and once they came in, they used a combination of brutality, terror, and control through committees that they have learned from other Islamic societies, these neighborhood committees. If you watch some of these documentaries about how they control it, it's very similar to how they initially began to dominate Iran, for example. They had these neighborhood committees, young men with machine gun who claimed to represent God and would deliver swift justice, mm-hmm. and have absolutely no compunction to say, we don't care about human rights. They look you in the camera. This is virtually in the camera. One of the revolutionary courts says, we don't care about human rights. We follow Sharia. We went wrong when we decided to try to follow human rights.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where there's only time for one last question. Do you think there would be and this is not a speedy solution, but that the movement towards a solution would actually be accelerated by the U.S. pulling out of there and letting the Islamic world deal with this on their own?
No, I don't think so. I gave you a lot of bad news, but let me also give you some good news. There is a remarkable new generation coming in the Middle East. The women of the Middle East, in many parts of the Middle East, not all of it, the women of Iran, look at the middle of women of Iran. Look at the Islamists of Tunisia. Look at the youth in some other parts. These are places, in my view, that offer me hope. I am extremely hopeful about the future of Iran. I am conservatively hopeful about the future of Turkey. And if you look at the Middle East in the last 100 years, what has happened in Iran and Turkey and Egypt has prefigured the landscape. If we can get two of these three moving in the right direction, and Iran, in spite of its despotic veneer, is a society that has changed. Read the latest Economist on that. It's a society that is changing by women who are at the forefront of the democratic struggle, by youth, by internet savvy. Internet savvy always doesn't have to be used for torture. It can also be used to connect men and women together, as the cleric clergy are discovering, and they're trying to gender segregate social space.
Well, I'm sorry to say that this evening is coming to a close. And our special thanks to Dr. Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University and Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. And I'm Robert Rosenthal. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.